Sherlock Holmes versus Dracula, a play for radio by Glenn Dearman from the writings of Dr. John H. Watson, as edited by Lauren D. Estelman. With John Moffat as Sherlock Holmes, Timothy West as Dr. Watson, David March as Count Dracula, and Aubrey Woods as Professor Van Helsing. Sherlock Holmes versus Dracula.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is John Watson, friend and contemporary of Sherlock Holmes, about whom I have written certain accounts that have, I am flattered to say, been well received in many quarters. About this particular case, I have until now remained silent. However, I feel it my duty to set the record straight regarding a number of erroneous statements made recently concerning the events that I am about to describe. I refer in particular to a spurious monograph authored by an Irishman by the name of Bram Stoker, and entitled Dracula. To begin with, the book completely ignores the part which Sherlock Holmes, and to a lesser extent myself, played in bringing that affair to its successful conclusion. Although Holmes does not agree, it is my belief that Stoker was induced by the unscrupulous Professor Van Helsing deliberately to falsify facts in order to inflate his own reputation as a supernatural detective. What follows will show, I think, that I do not make this charge lightly. I need hardly consult my notebook for 1890 to recall that it was in August of that year that my friend Sherlock Holmes, with some slight assistance from myself, set out to unravel the most terrible and bone-chilling mystery which it has been my privilege to relate. The heat wave, which at the beginning of August had emptied London of all those fortunate souls who could afford to leave for the cooler temperatures of the country, had just broken. I had sought to make use of the break by taking the air, and thus giving my long-suffering wife a chance to forgive the unreasonable misanthrope with whom she had been living for the past few days. It was late morning when I chanced to drop in upon my friend in his bohemian lodgings, and I found him hard at work transcribing information into one of those commonplace books upon which so many criminals would dearly love to lay their hands. I settled myself in a chair and waited for Holmes to finish. After a few minutes' silence, he looked across at me.
"You are right, Watson. Dr. Grimesby Roylott was indeed a murderer and a bully, who no doubt richly deserved his fate."
"No doubt. My dear Holmes, this is too much. Am I to assume that you have now transcended the bounds of the rational and are competing with palmsters and mind-readers?"
"Nothing so mysterious, Watson. There is no magic at 221B, unless one counts the ability to observe and make deductions based on those observations."
"But I have done nothing that could be observed. I've been a fixture since I sat down."
"No man is a fixture. He may think he is. And yet, by a careful observation of his unconscious gestures, of his expression, and of the direction in which his eyes wander, a close reasoner would find rare instances in which he could not divine the mental processes of a man deep in thought. For example, as you sat down, I noted that your attention was momentarily claimed by my little monograph on poisons lying on the table. It is open at the chapter which deals with vipers and their venom. Now, since our only brush with such a means of death occurred in the case of the swamp adder used by Dr. Roylott in the attempted murder of his stepdaughter, it was not difficult to surmise that your thoughts were turned in that direction. My suspicions along these lines were confirmed when I saw a look of disgust and revulsion across your face. And when that expression turned to one of righteous anger, I was certain that I was on the right track. Whereupon I agreed with you that Dr. Roylott was a bounder of the worst sort, and was pleased to see by your reaction that my reasoning was sound."
"Oh, Holmes, Holmes, you do yourself a disservice by explaining your methods. The effect would be so much greater if you left your subjects in the dark."
"And your chronicles of my little exploits would, as a result, be shelved, alongside the fanciful works of Monsieur Verne and the Brothers Grimm. But tell me what you think of this telegram."
"Hmm?"
"It arrived this morning."
"Would like to consult you regarding lead column in this morning's Daily Graph. Thomas Parker, Whitby, Yorks." "Well, have you read the article?"
"I have. The problem presents one or two interesting facets. I think we should both profit from learning more of the particulars." "Come in.
Mr. Holmes."
"That is correct. And you, I take it, are Mr. Thomas Parker of Whitby."
Yes.
"Allow me to introduce my friend and colleague, Dr. Watson."
"How do you do?"
"How do you do?"
"Please sit down, Mr. Parker."
"Thank you. You've read the item I mentioned in my telegram?
I have indeed.
I am its author.
I'm aware of that.
Oh, indeed? How?
The ink stains on the insides of the index finger and thumb of your right hand told me that you spend much of your time writing. That you are seldom off your feet is borne out by the rundown appearance of your heels. Well, journalism is the only profession I can think of which combines such energy with the more placid activity of putting pen to paper. I thought it likely that you were the same journalist who had written the rather interesting account to which you directed me, but all this is elementary. Pray, tell me, what is on your mind?
Mr. Holmes, I've been authorised by my editor to extend you a fee in return for providing us with a solution to the mystery which took place in Whitby Harbour at midnight last night.
Yes, yes, yes. We can discuss such things as my fee later, Mr. Parker. For the moment, I wish to hear a summary of the facts as you know them, in your own words, independent of the restraining hand of your editor.
Very well. Until yesterday evening, the weather in Whitby has been much like that which you are now enjoying in London. Just before midnight, however, the air suddenly became so oppressively still that even the most ignorant town dweller would have realised that a storm was approaching. There is a great flat reef in Whitby which has caused the wreck of many a vessel unaware of its presence.
Yes, I know of it.
Well, the Royal Navy has installed a searchlight on top of the East Cliff for the purpose of guiding craft through the narrow alley that is the only safe passage from the open sea into the dock area. Last night, I was assigned by my editor to accompany the workers who were to put the light into operating order and report on the project's worth. I arrived at midnight, and as I did so, the storm struck. The wind howled and the rain lashed the cliff. The workers had all they could do to hold their footing as they swung the searchlight into position. And a great sigh went up when the light was lit and its beam shone out through the rain and darkness. When we saw what the beam revealed, however, that sigh was strangled in our throats. In the circle of light, a foreign schooner with all its sails set was racing towards the reef.
Foreign, you say? What were her colours?
She flew none, but her hull was unmistakably Russian in design.
I see. You go on.
Well, we braced ourselves for the crash we believed inevitable, and then a curious thing happened.
Yes?
Just when all seemed lost, the wind, which had been raging in an easterly direction, suddenly shifted to the northeast, and the schooner glided smoothly and easily into the harbour. Well, this was so unlike the disaster we had been expecting, and the abrupt change of wind such an unheard-of occurrence that I doubt any of us believe what our eyes told us. Well, I hope I'm not boring you with these details, Mr. Holmes, for I am trying to impress on you what it was like to witness the event.
On the contrary, it is a most lucid and informative account. What happened then? Well,
our feelings of joy were premature, for as the schooner slid past, the searchlight fell upon the most horrendous sight, that of a corpse lashed to the helm.
Good heavens.
We were all so shocked that the men forgot to swing the light and the vessel slid from view. By the time they had recovered enough to act, there was a wrenching sound followed by a crash, and the schooner had run aground on the sand near Tate Hill Pier. Oh, there is one more incident to tell you, although I doubt it is of much use.
Every scrap of information is of use at this point, Mr. Parker.
Well, no sooner had the light been trained back on the deck of the ship than something that looked like an immense dog leapt up from below and bounded off into the darkness.
A dog?
Yes, I assumed it was a pet of one of the crew, but you may have some other theory.
As I've told the good doctor here on more than one occasion, it is a capital mistake to theorize before one has all the evidence. But it does seem strange that the captain would allow one of his crew to carry a large pet on board when space is so important. Well,
perhaps that is a question best left to a student of the Russian mind.
We have yet to establish that the captain and crew were as Russian as the
schooner. Yes, excuse me, but has no one questioned the crew about the mystery of the dead man and the dog?
That would be quite impossible, Doctor. You see, with the exception of the corpse at the wheel, there was no one on board ship.
Good Lord.
Tell me, Mr. Parker, who was first on board after the ship had beached?
The Coast Guard on duty.
Did he examine the dead man?
Yes, sir. And threw up his hands in terror as he did so.
Indeed. And why was that?
Mr. Holmes, I saw the dead man's face when I went aboard. It was distorted so grotesquely that it was difficult to believe that it was the face of a human being.
Distorted how?
With horror. Naked, unrestrained horror. Such horror as no man has experienced since the beginning of time.
Yes. You have a poetic turn of phrase, Mr. Parker. I urge you to put it to constructive use. Describe the body.
A man some years past middle age, black-bearded. His hands were lashed to the wheel, one over the other, in the manner of a seaman who wishes to prevent himself from being carried overboard in rough weather. The chafing of the cords had cut his wrists to the bone, but it was the object that he held in his hand that claimed my interest.
And what was that?
A rosary, sir. with the beads wound around both wrists and the wheel. It was a strange sort of thing to find in those circumstances, hence my interest. That is all I can remember, save for the wounds.
Wounds?
Two puncture marks at the throat, perhaps an inch apart, ragged at the edges and somewhat puckered. The authorities have asked us to withhold that information to avoid panicking the local population with the fear that a wild animal is loose in Whitby.
I assume a physician was summoned?
Yes, sir. A surgeon, Mr. Caffin, was called in to examine the corpse. He declared the sailor to have been dead for at least 2 days. In the pocket of the man's jacket, he found a bottle with a number of pages of closely written script rolled up inside. I have since learned that they are an addendum to the ship's log. So far, the press have been refused access to it.
Excellent. You have a sharp eye, Mr. Parker. And what of the ship's cargo?
50 wooden boxes, measuring some 7 feet by 3, containing nothing but plain earth. I am ignorant as to their ownership or purpose.
And the dog? What happened to it after leaving the schooner?
No one knows. It has disappeared.
An appealing problem, Mr. Parker. Most appealing.
Well, does that mean you will accept the assignment, Mr. Holmes?
I shall be delighted. You may inform your editor that Mr. Sherlock Holmes will look into the problem and that he will notify the Daily Graph as soon as he has reached a solution.
Thank you, sir. I am most grateful.
Well, Watson, what do you make of it all?
It seems a somewhat dark and sinister business.
I agree wholeheartedly. There was something aboard that ship, something that no man could look upon without risking the loss of his life or reason, and it is up to us to uncover it.
What about the dog? And the strange wounds on the dead man's throat?
Those, my dear Watson, are the mysteries which you and I are going to clear up when we reach Whitby. Unless, of course, your practice cannot spare you for a few days.
Oh, yes, indeed it can. I will see to it that all my patients are referred to my neighbour and inform my wife that she will not see me for a while.
Then make haste, Watson, make haste. I warrant that the adventure of the foreign schooner will make an admirable addition to your little collection of thrillers.
Within the hour, we were in a first-class coach and rattling over the rails on the way to Whitby. Holmes would have none of my attempts to draw him into conversation about the case, so much of the journey was spent in silence. In response to a telegram to Mr. Parker, informing him of the time of our arrival, the journalist was waiting for us when we alighted at Whitby Station. With him was an elderly gentleman with white flowing hair, whom, much to my surprise, Holmes greeted warmly.
Good day, Mr. Caffin. I'm pleased to make your acquaintance.
You have noticed the bulge of the stethoscope in my pocket, Mr. Holmes. For a moment I thought that you had done something remarkable.
Indeed.
Mr. Caffin has expressed an interest in this affair, Mr. Holmes. I thought that perhaps his findings on the death of the seaman might prove useful.
Any information he can supply would be most helpful.
It is an extremely puzzling case.
How so?
I can see no reason for it, and yet I would stake my reputation on the fact that the man died of a severe loss of blood.
And the puzzle?
Well, with the exception of 2 tiny punctures in his throat, which were far too small to be the reason for the loss, there were no wounds to be found on the body.
I see.
And another feature worries me. There was not a drop of blood to be found anywhere on the ship.
You have my apologies, Mr. Parker. Until now, I have been referring to your mystery as a little one. I shall not do so again. Have you any new developments to report?
Only that early this morning, a dog belonging to a local coal merchant was found dead near Tate Hill Pier with its belly slashed open by a savage claw. I can only think that this discovery must have been a victim of our missing canine.
Interesting. Most interesting.
But you must be tired after your journey. I have booked rooms for you at the hotel. After you have rested, I would be honored to take you to the schooner.
I think I speak for Dr. Watson as well as for myself when I say we should be most eager to look into your mystery before we rest, Mr. Parker.
Yes, indeed.
I was hoping you'd say that. I have a four-wheeler waiting to take us to the pier.
Have you discovered the name of the schooner yet?
Oh, yes, sir. It's called the Demeter.
A sea fog had settled over everything by the time we reached the harbour. The rather choppy waters had turned a gunmetal grey, and the vessels anchored in the area were reduced to indistinct shadows. Near the base of the pier, the schooner Demeter, with her sails in rags, was perched on a narrow mound of sand. Instead of boarding the ship, as I had expected, Holmes spun on his heel and trudged off across the beach. with head bent and hands clasped behind his back, studying the sand at his feet. At intervals, he flung himself down onto his stomach and peered at something through his lens. I stole a glance at the two men at my side and saw that they were watching him with puzzled smiles. As with most people, seeing my friend in action for the first time, they did not realize, as I did, that every one of his strange procedures was applied towards a definite end. When at last he returned to where the rest of us were standing, he wore a crestfallen expression which quickly became accusing when he turned it upon Thomas Parker.
The cargo has been unloaded.
Why, yes. Some men came for it this morning with five wagons. I was not here at the time and so was not able to question them. Their papers were in order, so they were allowed to take away the 50 boxes. But I mean,
it's incredible. You engage me to solve a mystery, and then you make it impossible for me to do so by allowing others to trample all over the clues and take away the one bit of evidence I need to solve the problem.
I'm sorry, sir.
Come, Watson. Let us board the ship. Perhaps between the two of us we'll be able to piece together what little remains.
Of course, Holmes. Of course.
Oh. Now stay here while I inspect the deck. Watson, over here.
Where? I can't see you in this confounded fog.
By the helm, man. We are in luck, Watson. The ignorant fools who allowed priceless bits of evidence to be carted away had the foresight to cut the rope that bound that poor unfortunate man to the wheel, rather than to attempt to untie the knots.
You've reached a conclusion, then?
Only that Parker was right in assuming that the captain had lashed himself to the wheel. There are indentations in the rope ends that could only have been made by the man's teeth as he pulled the knots tight. But at least we know that for certain now.
And your examination of the deck?
Yielded nothing. The teak is too clean to show footprints. The rail is a different matter, however.
Ah, what have you found?
Blood, Watson. Blood. Our friend the doctor was in error in stating that there was none of it to be found on board the ship. I have discovered three places where drops of it spattered onto the rails when the bodies of the crew were cast overboard.
You are certain they were murdered, then?
Oh, my dear fellow, I was never in doubt of the fact. But we'll discuss these things in greater detail when we're alone at the hotel. Now, perhaps you would care to rejoin Mr. Caffin and Mr. Parker while I go below. I shall not be a moment. You see, Watson, it was imperative to the murderer that every last one of those aboard be killed, for he could not afford to take the chance of one of them telling what had occurred during the voyage.
But who is he, and why did he kill them?
I'm afraid I must disappoint you. I have as yet no answer for your first question, and although I have a theory regarding the second, it is too tenuous for me to air it at the moment. But I will say this. Our murderer is a man of tremendous strength. It's no easy task to fling the limp body of a full-grown man over a rail 3 feet high.
Well, surely it's no feat to drag.
No one was dragged.
My dear Holmes.
There were no heel marks on the deck, and the blood on the rail was not smeared. No, Watson. The murderer was capable of lifting at least as much as 14 stone high over his head and hurling it over the side.
Good Lord. If what you say is true, then we are dealing with a brute.
Precisely. Come in.
Mr. Holmes, I...
Oh, Parker, my dear fellow. What has happened? You look quite done in. Watson, a glass of wine for the man.
Yes, of course.
No, that's quite all right. It's merely that I am of an excitable temperament, and recent events have proved rather much for me. I will be my normal self again in a moment.
Well, sit down. How may we be of service to you?
I fear you will not be pleased by my answer. I am here to ask you to abandon your investigations.
Indeed. I was not aware that my methods were so unsatisfactory.
Oh, it's not that, sir. The mystery has been cleared up.
May I ask how?
This is a translation from the log of the Demeter. All the answers seem to be contained in it.
I should prefer to hear your interpretation of its contents, Mr. Parker.
It seems obvious enough. The Demeter sailed from Varna on July the 6th. Aboard were five hands, two mates, a cook, and the captain, who appears to have been the man we found lashed to the wheel. 10 days later, one of the crew was reported missing. A search was launched, but to no avail, and it was decided that he had fallen overboard during his watch. Within a week, another man was lost, under the same circumstances. By the first week of August, only the captain and his first mate were left aboard ship. The captain himself was manning the wheel at midnight on August the 3rd, when the mate, screaming incoherently about something horrible in the hold, scrambled up from below and hurled himself over the side. The captain stated in his August the 3rd entry that he was convinced his mate, then a hopeless madman, was responsible for the sailors' deaths.
But what of this entry for the 4th? I dared not go below, I dared not leave the helm. So here all night I stayed, and in the dimness of the night I saw it. Him. And later. But I shall baffle this fiend or monster, for I shall tie my hands to the wheel when my strength begins to fail, and along with them I shall tie that which he, it, dare not touch. And then, come good wind or foul, I shall save my soul and my honour as a captain. Well, I must say that those are strange words for a man who has seen the perpetrator of these heinous crimes take his own life.
Well, when that was written, the captain had been at the helm for nearly 24 hours without relief. I think you can put it down to the ravings of a man in the throes of complete exhaustion.
And the captain's death? I'm very curious to hear your theory as to the cause of the severe loss of blood.
Mr. Caffin is a fine surgeon, but he is also elderly. I think that perhaps he mistook an anemic condition for blood loss. The man died, I should guess, of heart failure brought on by that same exhaustion which caused his delusions.
My word, but you have all the answers. Then surely you can explain the presence of the punctures in the man's throat.
And do not forget the dog.
Quite right, Watson. By all means, let us not forget the dog.
The dog, of course, belonged to one of the dead sailors. I am unable to explain the punctures unless they were shaving nicks.
You, sir, are a disgrace. A disgrace to the legions of honest men and women who have courted death 1,000 times over to make your profession the powerful organ of justice that it is today. Go. Take your transcript and leave. My colleague and I have no time for snivelling whelps who grovel before the voice of authority.
Yes, sir.
There is one journalist who will think twice before he places himself in the middle again.
What was all that about?
He's covering up, Watson.
Why should he do that?
You saw his condition when he came in. Mr. Parker is a very frightened young man. Someone has decided to lay our little mystery to roost.
You do not seem surprised at this development.
I knew some influence was being brought to bear when I came across sets of wagon ruts leading to and from the stranded schooner. Evidence that its cargo had been carried away. Paw prints left by the infamous dog, chance to inspect the cargo, all have been lost. I cannot conceive of that being allowed to happen unless the action had already received the sanction of someone in authority. I owe you an apology, Watson.
Whatever for?
For embroiling you in a case that can never be solved because of the official ramparts which have doubtless already been flung in our path. Tomorrow, we'll return to London and forget the whole affair.
I saw nothing of Holmes throughout the next few weeks, although I read of him a great deal. The murder of Sir Oliver Worth Benton of Coventry and subsequent arrest of his wife occupied the front pages of the London dailies for many a week. And when my friend was able to prove conclusively that Lady Worth Benton was innocent and that the gardener held more than a passing motive for having murdered his employer, one could scarcely walk down to the corner without hearing the detective's name mentioned. As for myself, I was too busy with my practice to leave my consulting room for more than 10 minutes at a stretch, for the end of the holiday season had brought its usual quota of insect bites and summer colds. So I was taken completely by surprise when, shortly after I had retired on the evening of the 27th of September, my wife awakened me to tell me that Holmes was waiting for me downstairs.
I'm sorry to disturb you at this hour, Watson, but if Mrs. Watson has no objections, I should like to borrow you for a few days. Something has come up in which your services may prove of considerable value.
Well, I don't know if Mary...
The change will do you good, John. I shall see to it that Jackson takes over your practice.
Excellent. Pack a bag, Watson, for you will be staying with me until this business is concluded.
I will see to that.
Thank you, my dear. Now, what is all this, Holmes?
You will find a summary of the events of the past week on the front page of this issue of the Westminster Gazette. Mm-hmm. I think that one or two of the details may claim your interest.
The Hampstead Horror?
Read on.
Although there have been no fatalities as yet, the discovery on Hampstead Heath over the preceding 4 evenings of small children, badly frightened and somewhat weakened but otherwise unharmed except for slight injuries,
brings back memories of the shocking atrocities wrought in the East End by the fiend known as Jack the Ripper 2 years ago. The only information the constables have been able to glean from the young victims is that a bloofer lady dressed in white had asked them to come with her into the shadows, and the next thing they remembered was being alone in the darkness until a policeman or early morning stroller came upon them. In all cases, the tots have shown a uniform lack of ability to explain either their weakness or the wounds found upon their throats. The wounds seem such as might have been inflicted by a rat or some equally small animal, and their presence suggests that the culprit called the Bloofer Lady may be a dangerous monomaniac performing experiments on small children with laboratory animals. What a beastly business.
Beastly? Well, yes, I suppose you're right. But come, Watson. Surely your professional altruism is not so fully developed that it has been allowed to impair your logic. What significance, for example, do you attach to the children's weakness and the presence of these singular wounds upon their persons?
Well, weakness and dizziness are common reactions to a frightening episode. As for the wounds, it would be foolish to blame them on a chance meeting with a stray animal, since they've shown up on not one but four successive evenings. I believe the journalist who reported these incidents is correct in thinking that some demented practitioner has been conducting experiments in which a carnivorous beast is set upon a helpless child. The presence of a woman in white would seem to bear this out.
Admirable, Watson. I'm pleased to note that the years you have spent observing and chronicling my methods have not been wasted.
Oh, then you agree with my conclusion?
No, you're totally wrong.
Oh.
Now, what possible motive could a scientist, demented or otherwise, have in subjecting stray children to the bite of some predatory creature, then releasing them? Surely this person is aware that wounds will result? And yet the period that elapses between the time these tots are reported missing and the time they are returned to their parents is hardly long enough to observe any further reactions. So your crazed practitioner goes out of the window.
Well, then I confess that I'm quite in the dark. Why are these children wounded, and what caused the wounds? These are deep waters for me.
As deep, perhaps, as those which closed over the mystery of the missing crew of the Demeter.
Holmes, you don't think that the two cases are related?
The constable who discovered the latest of the child victims described the wounds on the boy's throat as a pair of punctures, roughly an inch apart and torn at the edges. Now, does this description strike a chord in your memory?
The wounds on the captain's neck.
Precisely. Now, as soon as your wife returns with your bag, we must be off.
Off where?
To Hampstead, of course. To explore the infamous heath. No doubt, Watson, you are wondering what we are doing here in the middle of nowhere.
Where are we going, Holmes? I'm more confused than ever.
Patience, my dear fellow. I promise that before this night is over, you shall have all the answers you seek. For the moment, we are making for the cemetery over there.
For what purpose?
To gain admittance to the white crypt in the center. Come. Here is where your lantern will prove useful, Watson. Cast a beam on the lock, and let us see if my talents as a burglar are... Hello. What's this?
The door's already open. What can this mean?
Draw your revolver, Watson. There is danger inside.
Shh! Who are those people, Holmes? And why are they gathered around that open coffin?
I believe I know.
My God! The body inside. It's the woman in white.
No! Am I asleep? No!
That man in the middle, he has a wooden stake in his hand. He's... Good God!
No! Again!
He's killing our host. Look, he's...
Wait!
It is done.
Professor Van Helsing, I think.
What?
And the others would be Dr. Seward and Arthur Holmwood, Lord Godalming. This gentleman I do not know.
Allow me to present Quincy Morris, A friend of Lord Godalming.
Sir?
Who are you? How is it you know my friend's names?
My name is Sherlock Holmes, and this is my associate, Dr. John Watson.
How do you do?
As to the rest, I shall be delighted to exchange information with you in a more convivial setting.
I accept your offer, Mynheer Holmes. I have a room at the Barclay. There you will tell me your tale, and I tell you ours. It is a tale not for the squeamish. It is a tale of Count Dracula. I judge by your friend's expression that he thinks himself in the lair of a murderer.
Absolutely.
He has not been told?
He has not been told for the simple reason that I myself did not know until recently.
Well, what exactly do you know, Mynheer Holmes?
I know that the woman whose existence you ended so abruptly tonight was a vampire. I know that in life her name was Lucy Westenra, and that she was engaged to be married to young Lord Godalming. I know also that the man who condemned her to her undead state arrived in England aboard the Russian schooner Demeter, which docked under the most mysterious circumstances in Whitby on August the 8th. I'm counting on you, Professor Van Helsing, to fill in the details.
Your reputation is well deserved. It would interest me to know in what manner you came to your conclusions.
There will be time for that later. For now, I think it is in your own best interest to tell us your story.
Well, my name, as you have already divined, is Abraham Van Helsing. I have been physician and lecturer at the University of Amsterdam for many years. There it was that I first met Dr. John Seward, and it was through him that I became involved in the case of Miss Lucy Westenra. This lady had fallen ill early in August, and in spite of recurrent episodes of seeming recovery, continued to fail until her very life was in danger. Most puzzling to my friend was that each relapse seemed to occur immediately after the lady was discovered walking in her sleep outside her lodgings in Whitby. Then came the incident which, when I learned of it, convinced me that we were dealing with something far more terrible than simple illness. A friend of hers, Miss Mina Murray, discovered her one night upon the stone of a suicide's grave in a cemetery near the house. Bending over her, in Miss Mina's own words, was something in black. When Miss Mina cried out, the thing raised its head and turned upon her a face with gleaming red eyes. By the time she got there, however, it had vanished. Miss Lucy had fainted. That night, her health began to fail again.
One moment. When was this, precisely?
The date was August the 11th.
I see. Pray continue.
It was shortly after this event that I was summoned. You have been rightly hailed for your powers of deduction, Mynheer Holmes, and yet I flatter myself that even your lightning-quick mind could not have arrived at the conclusion faster than did my own, once the stricken woman's symptoms were described to me. The thing in the cemetery, the sudden decline, the presence of two tiny wounds upon her throat. Was there ever a more classic case of the dark things of the night at work than this? Without hesitation, I took the precautions which have been ingrained in me since childhood. Strands of flowering garlic I strung about the windows of Miss Lucy's bedroom, a silver crucifix I placed about her neck. But alas, these were wasted efforts, for I had not taken into account the ignorance of Miss Lucy's mother, who removed the garlic in order to allow her daughter to breathe the night air. If only that were all that entered the room that night. The final decline had begun. On September the 20th, Miss Lucy expired. And on that night, the Bluefer lady was born.
What ineffable twaddle! Holmes, this creature is seeking to escape a charge of murder by claiming that he did nothing more than aid in the destruction of a phantom, when it is obvious that his victim was flesh and blood. I've never seen a more flimsy attempt at disguising one's guilt.
Sit down, Watson. Professor Van Helsing speaks the truth.
But... very well.
Professor, earlier this evening you mentioned a name that was unfamiliar to me. Who is Count Dracula?
We struck a bargain, Mynheer Holmes. First, I must hear how you have come to know what you know.
Oh, that is of little consequence. After reading in the newspapers of the recent occurrences concerning the woman in white, I came up to the heath to the spot most frequently alluded to in the reports. I followed what I believed to have been the impressions left by the Blufa lady's quite tangible feet to the Godalming crypt. After that, it was a simple matter to peruse back issues of the local Hampstead paper until I came upon the death notice of one Miss Lucy Westenra, betrothed of Lord Godalming and attended during her illness by Dr. John Seward and Professor Abraham Van Helsing. When I learned that she had been transferred here from Whitby, my interest became acute. I made contact with Dr. Watson, and we travelled to the heath together. It did not seem to be going too far to identify the men we found gathered around the coffin this evening as those mentioned in the newspaper.
Brilliant.
But elementary.
It is the very simplicity of the thing that I find so brilliant. But I have paid you compliments enough for one night. Who is Count Dracula? As well you may ask me, who is Lucifer? For the two have much in common. According to my friend, Professor Arminius of the University of Budapest, Dracula was that proud descendant of Attila's who led his horde against the bloodthirsty Turk over 4 centuries ago. Even then, in the days before it is said he offered his immortal soul to the evil one in return for everlasting life, Dracula was spoken of as vampire, berserker. Still is he spoken of as such in the land which once he ruled. Jonathan Harker, in May of this year, journeyed to Castle Dracula in distant Transylvania to aid the Count in purchasing a suitable estate near London.
Where is this estate?
It is called Carfax. It stands upon a byroad at Purfleet. Mynheer Harker's stay in Transylvania was a circus of horrors, from which he was able to escape only through terrible risk of his life. What took place after this estate was acquired by Dracula, I have been able to piece together from newspapers, from my own experience, the appearance in Whitby of a Russian schooner piloted by a dead man last month, carrying a cargo of 50 boxes of earth, tells me that Dracula has docked in England. He it was who condemned our poor Miss Lucy to her undead state, from which we were able to free her only this evening. As her avengers, our next step is to seek him out in his present lair and destroy him before he can contaminate another soul.
Oh, really?
I see, Doctor, that you are skeptical.
I most certainly am.
Well, I once laughed, as you do, at the idea of vampires, of corpses that prey upon the blood of the living. I laugh no more. For I have seen the evidence of their unholy existence. Now I know their strengths and weaknesses as well as I know my own. By day they are powerless. Then they rest in coffins upon or beneath the soil of their homeland. Until now, we who have studied Nosferatu, the undead, believed that this of necessity bound the vampire to his native shores. But by taking with him an ample supply of earth from Transylvania, Dracula is free to haunt the four corners of the globe with impunity, so long as he may remain undetected. We know of his appetite. The deaths of 9 seamen during the month-long voyage from Varna to Whitby told us this. We know from the appearance of what observers called an immense dog on board the beach ship that Dracula can change his shape at will. He can, at least in his immediate vicinity, command the elements. Witness the sudden gale which struck Whitby on the night of the Demeter's arrival. Miss Lucy's rebirth as the Blufa lady is evidence enough that his victims become themselves vampires. As if all these things are not enough, he has the strength in him of 2 dozen men, who but a brute could have succeeded in hurling overboard the limp corpses of his victims at sea. So now you see, gentlemen, the magnitude of the task we have set for ourselves.
Has he no weaknesses? Have you no weapons with which to combat this fiend?
No weapons. We have a plenty. Wolfsbane is one, garlic another, but most feared is the Holy Cross and all that goes with it. By day and by night we may operate, while during the hours of sunlight Dracula must rest. And to bring to an end his unclean existence, we have the wooden shaft. By such means may the vampire be rooted out.
Bravo, Professor Van Helsing. You have laid out a preliminary plan of action much as I would have done myself. The information which you have provided is of great value. In return, my colleague and I would be happy to lend our own limited powers to the task you have so eloquently described.
I am grateful, Mynheer Holmes, but that will not be necessary.
I beg your pardon?
Please do not take offense. It is not that we would not welcome the application of your remarkable powers to this labor, but rather that we would prefer to avoid notoriety. Even in my country, we are familiar with the good doctor's accounts of your more interesting cases, and we are anxious not to have publicity that may panic all of Britain.
I assure you, sir, that Dr. Watson and I will be most discreet.
I am sorry. Now, I must ask you to leave so that I may confer with my companions.
Why, if you do not desire our assistance, have you told us so much about Dracula? Why didn't you simply refuse to take us into your confidence?
I suppose I had. Would you have abandoned your investigation?
Certainly not.
There. You see?
You are committing a grave error, Professor Van Helsing. I urge you to reconsider.
The matter is closed. If either of you should attempt to interfere, I shall be forced to take drastic measures. Good day.
Come, Watson.
Good day, sir. Well, I suppose that's that.
On the contrary, that is definitely not what it is.
Whatever you mean, how can we go any further in this business without Van Helsing's aid?
You are no longer sceptical?
Oh, I'm always sceptical. But I admit I'm not so sure of my ground as I was.
Good. Then you will journey with me tomorrow night to Purfleet, where we will pay a call upon the vampire in his lair.